Welcome to another edition of NDTI's Talking Inclusion podcast. My name's Drew Edwards, and today I'm joined by Siraj and Jackie from Changing Our Lives, who've been working with us on a project called 200 Lives, which is all about evaluating supported living and residential care for adults with learning disabilities. Welcome, both of you. If I could start by asking you to introduce yourselves, please.
Yeah, so hello, my name is Siraj Indizat, and I'm a senior community of life facilitator at Changing Our Lives. And I've been with Changing Our Lives for more than about 12 years now.
12 years?
Yeah.
I had no idea you'd been there that long. And Jackie?
I'm Jackie Taylor, and I'm a Senior Development Officer with Changing Our Lives. So I've been with Changing Our Lives for nearly 8 years now, and been involved in a wide variety of work over those years.
So we're here to talk about the 200 Lives project. I wonder whether you could tell me a little bit about how you worked on the project.
So we were part of a bigger research project. We worked with a number of partners, and we were doing the task to do some quality of life reviews, finding out about a person's life. So we had a small team of 5 people. We went to 14 places as a whole, 8 places that were supported living, and 6 which were residential homes. We wrote a report for each person that we talked to. And we wrote a video report to state the main themes. We spoke to the people themselves. We spoke to the people that they knew them very well. And the staff who supported them. We had conversations. It was very natural. We were led by the people that we spoke to. We had conversations with each person. Each conversation lasted about 1 or 2 hours.
I love the idea that it was very natural, that it felt, you know, that it was a very natural process of a way of finding out what people thought.
Yeah, I mean, that's what we normally do anyway. We put people at ease as well.
Were there challenges around it? Because this, I remember that this project sort of started and then we went into lockdown quite soon after. So what challenges did that bring up for you?
I think the main one really was not being able to actually go out and see people and sit with them face to face. So normally when we do a quality of life review, we go and visit people, and you know, we might sit and chat with them in the kitchen while they're cooking, or we might sit in the living room with them, whatever works best for the person really and puts them at ease. So we have that, you know, again, as natural as possible conversation with people about their lives. But while we're there, we're obviously observing the way that staff interact with people, you know, what their home is like, what they've got around them. You know, is it tidy, or is it just like a normal home and a little bit messy? They got their personal things around, all of those things we'd normally observe, and we just sort of be part of the daily flow of their life. But obviously, we couldn't do that because of COVID. So we had to set up, for most people, either Zoom calls or Microsoft Team calls. I think we did a few FaceTime calls as well with a couple of people. So that's a very different way of working. And it felt very strange at first. But I think we put a lot of thought into how we were going to make those conversations as natural as possible. So we tried to put in place things like maybe suggesting that people bring personal items to show us, or photographs. We thought of a few questions that might make it a little bit more interesting, so that people perhaps, I don't know, we had a bit of fun, or you know, we got people thinking, anything really, to just try and put people at their ease. On the whole, it worked pretty well. And the conversations actually ended up being quite natural, didn't they, Siraj? They were quite, sort of had their own flow to them. I think because we were doing quite a lot of reviews and they're quite sort of quite intense conversations sometimes, even though they're natural, it was important for us to keep them fresh as well, so that we weren't just churning through people, and that we were really listening and really kind of exploring with them what their life was like. So again, we tried to kind of throw in some interesting questions just to kind of to get something different about the person's life. So things like, you know, do you have a bucket list? What's on it? And, you know, what would your big dream be? Those kind of things. What makes you laugh? If you could be famous for anything, what would it be? That kind of thing, just to sort of get the person thinking or their support staff thinking in a slightly different way and keeping the conversation a bit more interesting. I think it was important that we had 5 people in the review team as well. So, you know, again, we were bringing different people in for different individuals, so that we didn't get dry or stale or go into autopilot. And we're very good as a team anyway in all the work we do at sort of reflecting with each other throughout projects. So there was plenty of that, plenty of opportunity for us to talk to each other and you know, just keep our ideas fresh, making sure that we were going to each individual with an open mind and you know, looking for what was individual about them. Also, when we wrote the reports, each individual report for each person we had, and separate member of the team having a look at those, so they could sort of spot if we were going into a bit of autopilot.
What kind of differences did you find in the things that were coming up? Were there, and you mentioned the theme, Siraj, you know, what themes sort of started to come together?
We focused on our quality of life standard, and we found some general themes and some specific as well.
In general, what we saw was that for people where they have a lot of support needs and they have a lot of staff support and they live in supported living, they tend to have quite varied and personalised lives, do quite interesting things, more so than they would perhaps if they lived in residential care. So people with sort of similar level of support needs in residential care had less sort of variety in their life. But what we also sort of seemed to be the case for in these small numbers was that for people who didn't need a lot of support, there was perhaps something about being in residential care that gave them a little bit more, maybe emotional support and just that sort of feeling of safety, really, that perhaps they wouldn't get if they, you know, somebody with similar level of support needs lived in the community. I think there was less social isolation, and perhaps that, you know, just particularly during COVID, that was something that, you know, was quite important. So one person in particular, you know, was sort of talking about, although they didn't necessarily always get on with everybody they lived with, there were people around them, they had sort of that support there during COVID. But in general, they felt that they got a lot of emotional support from the people they live with and the staff team. And if they lived in supported living, they wouldn't get that. So, yeah, that's sort of one of the general things that we notice.
The older people seem to be very happy that they live, but with supported living, people had more choice of where they live and who live. And that didn't come out as much in the residential care home. That in supported living, they can have their own stamp on their house. That one male, he had a basketball hoop in the corner of the room. And there were 2 ladies who had studio in there, so
what kind of, an artist studio or a music studio?
It was an art studio, yeah.
And I guess in terms of quality of life, having things like a basketball hoop or an artist studio would have made a real difference to how you were able to spend your time during the pandemic.
I think we saw that more in supported living, yes. Didn't you?
And they can help raise lifestyle as well. So that spontaneity is more in supported living than residing such a home.
So one of the other areas we were looking at was being in control of my life. And what seemed to us to emerge was that there's potentially some differences between being in supported living and residential care, but also living alone or sharing seems to make a difference as well. And then the third area was the amount of support that people get. They all seem to have quite a big impact on the amount of decisions that people make in their own life. What we found was that where people live in a group setting, particularly in residential care, a lot more seems to happen as a group. And it wasn't always clear how much that was a real choice for the person and whether or not they were given the choice to do some of those things on their own. So it was less the case in shared supported living. People tended to be doing more things on their own in shared supported living. You know, examples like sort of meals or activities or, you know, holidays, there tended to be more group decisions in a shared situation, which in some ways is perhaps natural if you're sharing, but in other ways, perhaps given the choice, people actually might do more of those things sort of more autonomously. We found that there was not an awful lot of planning in terms of people's lives outside of their leisure time. So things like contributing to the local community, moving towards work or a career, learning new skills and hobbies, having ambitions, personal development, you know, improving, I don't know, their, you know, photography skills or whatever. Most of the planning in people's lives seem to be around leisure and having fun, which is great, but it's not necessarily, you know, reflective of an ordinary life. We also found that people in supported living were more likely to be involved in running their own lives and less so in residential care. So, you know, things like paying bills, answering the door, answering the phone, arranging repairs, all of that kind of thing. We didn't see many examples of that in residential care. And sadly, we only found one example of a person in paid work, and that was sessional work rather than, you know, a permanent contract. Mm. I think the other thing which was very sort of its time was that we found that people were going back to life as normal after COVID much more slowly than the rest of the population. So while we had started to go back to maybe pubs or, you know, cafes, most of the people we spoke to hadn't started doing that yet and were behind the curve with returning to those things. And we found that people weren't very involved in making those decisions. So it seemed to be managers that were making those decisions rather than people themselves for themselves. And I think that was more so in residential care than supported living.
That was going to be my question, is was that a personal choice because they were anxious or they were still shielding, or was it because they had no choice?
I think it was done, the choice was done by the people that they were supported by. And I remember one that they said that oh, I joined the tour, but I stayed in the tour. And my supporter goes into the shopping area.
Going back to what you were just saying about the findings, it was just something that occurred to me. With the people having less choice over what they were doing, do you think that, or because they were doing sort of less things on their own, or things that they had chosen themselves, do you think that they would have chosen something different to what was going on had they been given the choice? So where they're joining in lots of group activities or joining in meal times or various other things, was that restricting their choice or were they quite happy with the way that things were going?
Most people appeared quite happy with it, but what we didn't know was whether, given the opportunity, they'd have been more happy doing something else. So it was almost as if, you know, and I suppose unless you're an assertive person, unless you know that actually I can ask for this and, you know, Bill down the road doesn't have to do everything with the group. He can choose to, you know, unless you sort of have some idea about that, I suppose it's quite difficult for people to, you know, push for it or even think that they could push for it. So it was difficult to say, I think, without sort of people being given the opportunity, we don't know.
And if it's all they've ever known.
Yeah, we'll find that people are having good lives. Comfortable life, but not necessarily or ordinary life. The new activity is maybe timetabled, not natural activities that we would go out to the shops or somewhere like that, but they may not have that amount of freedom.
It's related to the amount of planning that goes into somebody's that they're part of. So, you know, they're not planning many things outside their leisure time. So they're not doing many things out of their leisure time. So there was the absence of work, the absence of sort of, you know, contributing to the being active and contributing to the local community, development goals, ambitions, all of those things. So they might have been had busy lives full of lots of stuff, but it was all, you know, either segregated or leisure, or, you know, just having fun, which is nice, of course, but it isn't, you know, it's not an ordinary
life. And I think that's the really wonderful, from what you were just saying, Saroj, that distinction between comfortable life or ordinary life. Comfortable is something that people say to you when you're recuperating. It's just like, can I make you more comfortable? Just that, you know, rather than an ordinary life. Yeah. I think that's really interesting.
And it's that relationships as well. They have people around them, but it's not that new friends. It's the support. Not all the time. People are comfortable with the people that they live with.
I mean, you want support to be friendly, don't you? But you don't want that to be your only source of friends.
No, that's it. And I mean, the people that they live with, they don't want to be on them 24/7.
And I think the other thing was that where people had sort of friendships in their day services or in the groups that they were part of during COVID, not many people kept in contact with those people. So whereas we might have Zoomed with our friends or, you know, connected to our people at the football club or whatever, actually people tended not to do that, did they, Saroj? During COVID, so they weren't, the phone numbers weren't shared, or, you know, so they actually then no contact happened until those groups or services were set up again. We found as well that there were very few friendships with non-disabled people. Practically everybody we spoke to, their friends were other people with learning disabilities, so they hadn't made those other wider connections with non-disabled people.
And was that reflected in the activities that they were doing?
I think lots of people had busy lives or did sort of things that they enjoyed, but they were often segregated groups for other people with a learning disability. Everybody used local shops and cafes and the cinema, those sort of places. But in terms of where you're likely to go and meet other people and make friends because of shared interests, those tended to be the groups that were just for other people with a learning disability. So the opportunity to make those natural friendships, I think, was limited for most people.
And one more thing that when you're in the community where you live, you have to feel safe and some sense of belonging as well. And not just the visitor, and not just the tourist in your own community. That we normally say at the day of life as well.
The tourist in your own community, that's such a good way of putting that.
Yeah.
We also looked at the way people work with me, And a couple of the things that we noticed were that, firstly, staff don't always respect the privacy of the people they support. And that might be out of habit, or it might be out of a sort of a shared understanding. But at the same time, it does reflect that sort of power imbalance between sort of support staff and the people they support. So occasionally people, you know, when we observed it a couple of times where staff might walk into somebody's room without waiting for the knock to be answered. And then the second thing that struck us was that although some people are involved in the recruitment of support staff, it seems to be quite limited. So it might be asking a few questions of people that have come for interview, but then it doesn't seem to kind of turn into anything else. So being properly involved in deciding who gets the job, or writing job descriptions, or even giving feedback during the monitoring period, the probationary period of a member of staff, we didn't come across any examples of those things happening. So I think there's a lot more that providers can do to involve people in that process of, the whole kind of recruitment process of those people that are going to support them in their life.
So what recommendations did you make for how things could be different, or what would you like to see happen next? What do you hope will happen?
So people should really be living more ordinary lives in supported living. However, that doesn't happen automatically. And we've seen this through our quality of life review work over the years. You know, there are good examples of supported living out there, and there are poor examples of supported living. But we'd like commissioners to sort of make sure that that changes, that all supported living should give people more choice and more control than, you know, what a person would get in residential care. So it doesn't automatically happen. Good providers will make sure it happens, obviously, but that doesn't always translate into action. So yeah, we'd like to sort of see more people have that opportunity to live that ordinary life with their own tenancy, their own house, deciding their own support and deciding what they do with their life. I think one of the other things was that sort of recognising that although people might not have any or have very few practical support needs, sometimes emotional support needs, can be just as important, if not more important. So trying to support people who otherwise could live without 24-hour support, you know, just a few hours a week, but making sure that there's an emphasis on, ensuring that people are connected into their community, are connected into natural sources of support, do have friends, do have people to turn to if they're worried, you know, have somebody they can call to talk over an issue, and they're not just left sort of isolated waiting for that support worker to turn up. One person that we spoke to who lives in their own flat, in an ordinary block of flats in a town, is supported, has quite minimal support, but the team with him are thinking about him moving to a supported living scheme just so that he has more people around him and doesn't feel so lonely at the moment. He doesn't really know his neighbours. He's got a few set things each week, but he feels quite lonely. I think that's quite sad, really, because you know, that shouldn't be the case. He should have had the support to connect into the community around him and have more people in his life so that he doesn't feel lonely.
And coming out of lockdown, were people given a choice about how they then chose to spend their time? Were they given an opportunity to reevaluate what they would like to be doing?
Very often there seemed to be an assumption that people would return to life as it was before, and there was we didn't really find much evidence that it was being used, that the coming out of lockdown was being used as a time to think about, actually, do you want life to go back to how it was before? Or should we try this a bit differently? It seems like a good time because you haven't done A, B and C for ages. Do you want to try something else? Or should we, have you thought about, have you done anything different during lockdown that you want to carry on? So it was just that sort of, that's how life was. We've had lockdown and now we're going to go back to how it was up to a point. that's perfectly okay, isn't it? But then also it is an opportunity to think differently, but we didn't really see that that had happened.
We were to see. We were living in an ordinary life, not just the comfortable life. We were those that we were to have those connections, relationships, friendships, work, not just the dead-end job. And ultimately, we were commissioners and we were to finish hard with the planning as well.
And who would be involved? I think I know the answer to this, but who would you want to be involved in the planning of that?
The people themselves as well. Because the people themselves, they know what they need and they want and what they want as well.
That, you know, people need to be given that opportunity, need to have those conversations and be supported to explore all of those parts of their life rather than just, you know, having a life that's full of fun and, like Saroj says, comfortable, but has no other purpose. I mean, yeah. We all need that as human beings, don't we? And people with learning disabilities are no different.
And it's that this is the perfect time to change the processes, the way of thinking, the way of working, and we have to see what is in the future as well for these people, and not for only for these people, for everyone really.
And that looks like a good point to end on, Saroj. Thank you to you and to Jackie for joining me and talking about the 200 Lives Project. If you'd like to know more about it and the report that will be coming out shortly, go to www.ndti.org.uk. And we hope you can join us again in 2 weeks' time to listen to our next episode. Thank you.